Call the special meeting of Wayne Community to order. Just a couple of happy events here. No questions will be allowed during the presentation. Save your questions till the end. If the legislator is on Zoom and would like to ask a question, use the raise hand icon. You'll be called on. And just a reminder, you must be visible on screen as well. The Zoom chat has been disabled, and everyone has the presentation in the OneDrive, and for the public, it's online.
Good evening.
How's that?
Good.
All right. Very good. Well, thanks for having us back. Good to see folks, especially now after seeing some folks in person. Appreciate that. As I understand, that everyone has a copy of the presentation from the OneDrive and/or printed out here. I will flip through on the screen, but I also realize certainly my eyes wouldn't do very well for the screens here. So I'll try and kind of keep reference for where we are by image. So first, let's see. Good. On slide two, I wanted to give a bit of an overview of where we actually are in the whole project. So Urban and GTI and Alfondre put together the schematic design documents. Here I've done a bit of a timeline of sorts, starting kind of at 12 o'clock as it were. That was when we came on the project. I realized there was plenty enough sort of before that in terms of planning this, you know, yourselves involved, getting the approvals and so on, but that sort of 12 o'clock position is when we had our kickoff meeting. Coming around through the blue area, that was our extended site selection process and preliminary designs. Going into the purple, this is then now our design phase, in fact, and documentation. So there we go, right around to about what, about 4 o'clock?
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry.
This is for the public.
Absolutely. Christopher Young with Urban Architects, working with Rick Alfondre of Alfondre Architecture, and John Montaigne of GTI. I don't know if anyone else wants to introduce, but the rest is okay. Sorry about that. Right, so here we are at about kind of, you know, at 4 or 5 o'clock position. That's end of schematic design. We're essentially about 30% through the design process. The white, that's kind of light lavender there. That next phase there in the design process, design development. That's what we're getting ourselves into right now. And then from there into construction documents. Yellow sliver down by 6 o'clock, that will be the bidding and negotiation phase. Next on up is the construction phase, estimated about 15 months for that. And then beyond that, there's another 8 or 9 months just for the fitting out, getting all the equipment in, commissioning everything. So Everett and the Department of Emergency Services don't get in until we're back up at the top in about fall of 2025. Anyway, so I just want to kind of give that orientation. Other thing I want to kind of point out, I threw along the sides there a couple little kind of tick marks. The little green marks are kind of when, you know, we had presented before. There were sort of early ones back in May, June to legislature. Again, October. I think it's not shown. We did speak as well to the county executive in January. At each time, we've sort of been doing our due diligence to give a sense of not only where we are in the project, but also how the costs are shaping up. So at those kind of, so let's say column 2 and 3 o'clock points, we were given very, very high level estimate of what we expected the construction costs and all to be. Now that we've gotten to the end of the schematic design phase, it's gone out to a consultant of ours to do an estimate based on our 30% design documents. And that just came in, I think it was on Friday maybe, we kind of got the final revision of that. We got it earlier, a week or two before, and then had a vetting process among ourselves to make sure, is everything included? Are the numbers looking right? So that's now, in fact, part of the documents you have on the OneDrive document. Past that, in terms of estimating, on our side, it will be done, but the county is using the Palumbo Group as a construction management company, and they will, in fact, keep going. So when we're at the end of about 60% in this design development, another estimate, and then again, at about 90% of the design phase, they'll do another estimate. So that's, again, where we are. So stepping back, kind of where Department of Energy Emergency Services is. Over on Golden Hill, in the space, which I think everyone realizes is is too small, kind of inadequate for the purposes, and definitely kind of going forward in need of all the upgrades. Although, I don't know if you want to sort of chime in your own kind of note on.
No, I think I'm all right.
Sure. All right, that's fine. Both in terms of our site plan and our plans, here's our site plan, new building off of Paradise Lane in the town of New Paltz, parking lot in front, and then kind of the larger one showing connection from Paradise Lane and also kind of a bit of an emergency entrance coming off of South Ohioville Road. It's both for vehicles and also for utilities. We want the redundancy, not just for getting in and out in the cars, but also for our utilities, broadband services, and so on. So Central Hudson, Verizon, Crown Castle, we'll all be kind of pulling off of Paradise Lane and South Ohioville Road. I think probably since you would have last seen, let's say, in October, not significantly different from what we were figuring at the time. Same in terms of the building layout. So here again is what you would have seen. This is actually, I think, dated to April, but it's still essentially what you would have seen back in the fall with our Department of Emergency Services offices off to the left, the PSAP next to that, all in green, the red for the emergency operations center, kind of the heart of it, surrounded by conference rooms and other kind of split out spaces. Mostly for the EOC, but potentially for PSAP as well. In purple, the data center serving both Department of Emergency Services, their communications equipment, and also serving for Allen's and Information Services primary data center servers. And then the gray was our mechanical spaces. So that's where we were, and that was, sorry, I actually meant to give, that was on slide 7. Switching over. Oops, I think I lost it again.
Excuse me?
Oh, there we go. Sorry. Thanks. Slide 8. Slide 8, we've lost the color. Essentially, it's pretty much the same. We did need to work in an additional office, a private office for the EMS coordinator, but otherwise, we're kind of where we were. So what has gone on in that interim is just delving further into the building and figuring out what's needed, what's required here. So that was 8, and now flipping over to 9. So PSAP and the equipment and furniture systems that are required for the dispatch stations, as an example, or next over for the emergency operations center. Sort of laptop workstations for the majority of that space, and then in the back, a couple of kind of equipment-intensive command stations, as it were. That was slide 10. So 11. 11 is giving a reference to what our estimates had been back again. We're looking to October for our construction costs. We're looking at construction site work. We're also working in land acquisition and also soft costs as well. My eyesight's not so great, but 20.27 call it million for the construction, and then kind of with land and soft costs, and then we're up to about 20, almost 25. That was October, and now flipping over to today. Again, we've just gotten in the schematic design estimate from our consultant Trophy Point, and as it turns out, construction costs were pretty much spot on to where we were guessing at the high level. They've been taking a much more detailed systems narratives and drawings and really doing takeoffs to figure where all the construction costs should end up. And a little bit to my own amazement, honestly, our early kind of high level guesses and figurings were back quite close on. Land acquisition, more or less the same as it was, except I think we got a half million off of that. And then the design costs, you can't really see too well myself. I think if you got your printouts or at home, you can see a little bit better. There was the initial cost for Urban and our consultants. There was also the Palumbo construction management costs. There is an accounting for the extension in terms of the extended site visit, site selection phase. Oh, thank you. Thank you, thank you. The amendment for the extended site selection plus the larger building. And we put in a little bit more in terms of just a design contingency, you'll see, plus some amount that we anticipate for the brownfield cleanup as well. So that is up a little bit from before. As I say, land costs, in fact, are slightly down from where it's been. I'm looking sort of halfway down on, I think, what would be, I think it's slide 12. So we've been factoring the utilities. We don't yet have a number in from Verizon. That is still to come. The county, both Ulster and Dutchess, are still working with Verizon to figure out what exactly is needed. So that's a TBC item. But otherwise, we have in proposals from Zybex. Zybex is the supplier for the furniture systems and stations, for Motorola for the equipment. And antenna towers as well. So I think kind of the difference really from October is trying to figure out all that goes in for that equipment. So that last item there, the IT and communications item, is the difference from before. And then I think there's slide. Oops, did I look again? Slide 13. Actually, the last two slides, in fact, were just leftovers from the estimates. So I think slides 14 and 15 you can disregard, and if you have interest, just go ahead and look to that. It's the UC GOC costs with 2023-03-14. Otherwise, if you have the printout, you can disregard those. So that's kind of a quick overview of where things stand, both in terms of our process and also in terms of costs. And unless there's sort of other notes to add from back here, I think we could open up to questions.
All right. Legislator Ronson, you want to do your first on my list?
I'll wait.
Okay. Legislator Erner?
Thanks. It was just what the kind of the PSAP, some of these acronyms can.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Public Safety Answering Point, known to the rest of us as 911 Call Center.
And the EOC?
And the EOC was the Emergency Operations Center.
Let's say Walter.
Thank you. can you... So at the last conversation that we had, there are going to be some estimates on the two approaches in dealing with the water system. And I'm sorry, for the technology reasons, I don't have the slides. But can you just break down what the estimates are for either the digging of a well and doing whatever system you would need to do for that versus the estimates that you have for putting connecting it to the village water? And
sure.
A part of that is, can you clarify how many feet you are estimating, what's going into that estimate for the village water?
Sure. I'm going to have John do it, just for others to know, who maybe we're not part of that. Our original conception was that we'd be drilling a well for water just out of the ground. That's available. There's certainly good supply to be found. Maybe some questions, I think, in terms of whether it needs to be treated at all, but otherwise the water is there. But we're also not far from the water district. So, again, the last few months we've been evaluating, is it worth trying to get municipal water? And at our last Zoom meeting, there was that question, what and how do the numbers compare? So John at GPI, in fact, did a deep dive into that.
Christopher. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for having us. And Eva, I do appreciate the comment, because we did do some work on that since we last met. I think the most important thing to note here is that the offsite water is a water district that we're close to. There's water district number 3 and number 2. If you were to get municipal water here, the nice thing about it is that it would also provide municipal water for the balance of the property if we went ahead and looked at that. So what we would need to do is extend an 8-inch water line from just across the exit 18 thruway off-ramp where the park and ride is. That's where the water comes across right now into the thruway. And that would be about 135 feet that would come into the site. So what we were asked to do is take a look, first of all, about what the cost would be for doing the well and fire protection and everything you would do from a well source and add up what the cost for that would be. And then do an estimate on a simple design of the off-site water alternative. And so what we did is, first of all, we looked at the off-site water extension coming into the property and estimated that. 135 feet with a little bit of complications because of the thruway. The thruway would make us do what's known as a directional drilling, where you would drill under the ground with a carrying pipe and then you would run your water line through it, because they won't let you do an open cut through their road. Adds a little bit of cost to it. And then there's inspection and other things that have to be done to make sure the installation is proper. So for the 134 or 35 feet, plus or minus, including all of the design, consulting, construction, inspection, and certification requirements for it, it's about a $430,000 project. So conversely, we wanted to see what would be coming off of the estimate that you already saw here, that Christopher had up before. So on site right now for this, you would need a water storage tank for fire suppression. That's about $163,000. Then there's disinfection, filtration, the well itself, a well pump, a fire pump, and a pressure pump. All of that combined, including the excavation, comes out to about $371,000. And then if you add the contingencies and mobilization on that, you're about $446,000. So you can see that the on-site might actually turn out to be more expensive than the off-site option. With one caveat, we don't know what the pressure is in that 8-inch line right now until hydrant flow testing is done out there. So if the pressure is too low in that line, the only thing that you would have to probably put back into what I have pulled out is the fire pump itself that adds pressure. If there's a fire, it actually draws water out of the line. That would add about $53,000 back in. So you're looking at either a savings of somewhere around $14,000 to a potential add of maybe $40,000 to $50,000 to go with the municipal water, if that's an option that we can get worked through with the thruway. And again, for long-term maintenance, it's also a much better system to have municipal water than to have your own well, your own disinfection, your own water storage containment, and all of the other components that go with the on-site system. So from an engineering standpoint, if we can get the off-site water, it would be a better solution overall for the project.
We
might as well just get the water questions out of the way while you're up there.
Oh, sure.
Was there any? There's long publicized issues with the water on this property. Is there multiple aquifers, or are we talking about the tapping into the same water you mentioned, disinfection and filtration? Is it extra because there's a lot out there on salt and other things being in the water? Actually, there was a project that tried to go there before, and I think the water issues were one of the big issues setting that project back. So is that why we're leaning towards municipal? Is there more filtering than you'd like to see if there was just a clean aquifer, and does that add cost?
Well, so first let me explain. The production well that they were looking at is quite a bit further south on this property than where we would be putting our well. And it was in an area that was close to where the Department of Transportation and Thruway Authority had stockpiles of salts for road salt. It's a fairly common thing to have happen when you have those road salts, you know, over a long period of time without containment, that they leach into the surrounding ground. That well was, again, a very high-yield well that could have been almost at a municipal level, and that's how it had been looked at. Could have provided municipal water at a really significantly higher rate than anything that we would need here. And the reason they didn't move forward on that, or one of the reasons, was that, yes, there was salt contamination. They would have to do a lot of treatment, but that's a lot of treatment for a very large system. On a smaller system like this, The salt is what we have included in the number in our estimate for what you might have to do for water treatment on it to remove the extra salts, but not a deal breaker.
So there is
the filtration system would be about $23,000 of that cost. So
there is concern with this other the other aquifer that's further away that there may be some contamination there too.
It's the same aquifer. It's just the proximity to where that salt was. We're further away from that, and you know, until a well is actually drilled here and tested, we won't know 100%. But there was a small residential well that was there that. One of the environmental consultants that had worked for the prior owner had looked at.
Sure. It was just stated a minute ago that originally we thought we were going to be able to just drill down and take the water.
Correct.
That was just stated a minute ago. Correct. And now we're realizing we can't, but why would we have...
No.
We might not want to because of extra filtration.
No, I'm not sure why that question was, because we can always just drill down and take the water. Taking the water... So if you have a residential system, too, and you have hard water or you have other things, it's not uncommon to have a need for filtration on a
We're not talking system. About hard water, though. We're talking about actual contamination.
Well, salt is not that kind of a contamination. We're not talking about, you know, harmful chemicals or, you know, anything like that. And we're talking about a salt removal, which is a pretty straightforward process.
But it's salt coming from above the ground. So there's obviously runoff.
Any of the salt would have been what had leached down into the ground previously. That has been removed, and that source has been removed. So you've got residual that's down there that is on the southern end of the property, not where we are. We don't anticipate that being a big problem for us at all. Not at all here.
Because it's further away?
Because it's further away.
But we haven't tested it yet.
For the testing of the water? Well, we have included in our estimate a filtration system that would go in for any contaminants, not just for salts, but anything that we hit. That what you would find in groundwater source, in a well water source. Now, to your point, if we went with a municipal system, we've got treated municipal water, and we don't have that. And that's what I was saying would come out of the cost if we went that route.
Let you agree.
Thank you. I am asking about energy efficiency, energy savings. Is that built into the project?
Can we stay on water first?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is that? I mean, it just makes sense if he's standing up there. We should stay on water.
I have no issue with that at all.
You
were next, though.
I
have a question on water. I have a point of order to make, but I'll make it at the end. You know, because I don't want to waste our consultant's time and our money keeping them here. The municipal source. Do we have confirmation that in those water districts there is the capacity for us to be able to tap into it?
Yeah, there have been some preliminary talks with the municipal water source, and there's capacity in the line. And they're amenable to talking to us about the extension of the district.
Excellent, thank you.
Mr. Ben Walker?
I need to go yet, John. Should do the time for you. I'm running this.
More on water.
Thank you. I hadn't really finished with my questions, so I appreciate it. Thank you. So I'll just try to get them out as fast as I can. So one was this idea that the one water source, which is the shorter water source, does require going under the thruway. So I would be curious what really entails to get that kind of permission and the feasibility. The second water source is by the mobile, it's much further away, so I would imagine it's much more expensive. So I have just clarity on that. I would say to Legislator Ron, there is concern from the village about this added water capacity. We already have tremendous amount of water issues in the village right now, and so there is no concern about that. I also want to just add to this conversation about septic. I know that there's its own septic system, but if there's this talk about adding it to municipal resources, I've got a clear message that the septic option is not available up there to the village septic system. I wanted to just get that clarity over what was really entailed to go under the thruway and what's the pricing in terms of the mobile station. If that has to be the option, which also goes under a major state road, and then also be clear that the water does come from the village, not from the town. and the village does have concerns about this.
So let me go through one at a time. The two options that we looked at, one by the mobile station, one by coming off by the park and ride, are basically the same condition because the thruway actually owns a good portion of the radius of the turn. So we are dealing with the thruway on either option. And in addition to that, the land directly across and adjacent to the mobile station on the other side is also owned by the thruway. We found that as we did our research. So no matter what, either option would be dealing with the thruway. So we only estimated the one coming underneath exit 18's ramp because the other one would also come across and touch a portion of the end of exit 18 ramp coming around the bend. And the one coming off of the parking lot is the shortest run. The town, it is in a town water district, that is correct. The village does provide the water, and the amount of water that we are in need of for just regular domestic service at this building is low enough that we're not a high demand like the prior proposals were that were out here. We will have to go through a process known as a map plan and report, which is an engineered report, which is what I had identified as part of the cost in that $430,000, where we would look at all of the conditions that would be required by the village and by the town for extending the water district and providing the water. In that process, we would know and be able to verify that there aren't any issues with the supply from a municipal standpoint. And we believe we'll be able to work that through just given the volume that we have. Is there another question on there that I missed?
You're not coming under the thruway. You're coming under the thruway exit ramp.
Correct. They're not the thruway main lines. It's just the exit ramp. Oh, and the process. You wanted to know the process. So the process with the thruway is actually a fairly straightforward process. You go in and you meet with them, and they have a review process that is one where you do an informal review first. You identify what you're looking to do. They will require initial drawings of what we're proposing. They will be run by their engineering staff. As I mentioned, you can't just open cut a roadway. You have to do a directional drill, a carrier pipe, and then a pipe that you run through that. And that's been calculated in our cost estimate. It's included in the estimate that we came up with for $430,000.
Septic.
The septic we were not looking at. You're talking about a sanitary sewer system in the village, but we were never planning to try to tie into that. The sewer doesn't come over. We've always planned on doing a septic system on site.
Okay.
Legislator Quisley, you were next. Was it water related?
Yeah, it's water related. You had mentioned that a municipal option would be better for long-term maintenance. Is there actually cost savings over time that you've estimated?
I have not estimated that yet, but if you think about it, there's right now for a building related system, you have a well that has to be maintained. You have water pumps to pump all of that have to be maintained. You have an outside storage tank for your water storage, for your fire protection that has to be disinfected on a regular basis. So there's the systems that go along with that. So there's just a lot more components to the on-site system that the county would then have to put in their maintenance budget for the
I was just trying to figure out, is it a significant dollar amount or is it?
I don't have a number for that, so I hesitate even.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. DeKale.
Yeah, so thank you, Legislator Chris. Well, that was one of my questions is what would be the running cost of maintaining an on-site water system, including the tank and all the pumping and the annual maintenance, but you don't have that number. And the second question I had is what would be the cost of the water itself to the county from the village if they decided that they did want to go ahead and do that?
And that really all depends on whether or not we are able to get through the map plan and report process this property included in the water district, or whether we would be an out-of-district user. An out-of-district user is one where, because you're not in the district, they tend to charge you a higher price per gallon of water. So I think Dennis may have made a couple of calls on that, but right now I just know that an out-of-district user would probably be quite a bit more than the in-district. Our goal would be to get it in district right now.
So it's safe to say at this point we have no estimate on the annual maintenance cost for on-site water and no estimate for an annual cost for village supplied water, whether it be a new water district or any tying into the existing water district, right? We have no estimates on
that. I would say that's a safe assumption.
Thank you.
Yes.
Dr. Roberts. You were next on my list.
I don't think I raised my hand again. Would you like me to make my point of order now? I didn't want to waste the time.
Okay, I'll go back to you, Chairman Hill.
So you said that it would be 135 feet to connect the 8-inch water line?
The 135 feet is the amount that we would be directly going under the pavement.
And I'm just trying to get a sense of the number that you're giving us is not just for the connection, but the does it fully get the water to the building?
The price is to get it fully to the building and be a substitute for what we had designed for the well system.
So how long is that distance? You have the 135. So the 135 you're saying is the drilling under the. Is it possible for you to put the picture of the map up and just show us on there even, and then give the full distance of this connection?
Probably don't have this picture.
No, I don't. I do not have that. I do not have that one.
It's right there. Six or five or six, I think, is what we want.
No, I have, when we estimated it, we did a figure for it. Showed the outside design.
That, I think, is on the OneDrive, I believe.
Sure.
It has to be on the OneDrive.
It is.
Oh, so, just, you know how far is the connection?
I do not have the breakdown. I did not bring the entire estimate sheet that we did on this. I just have the drawing for it and the totals.
Okay. Could you provide that later?
Sure. Well, I think you might have this. Sorry. This is in the OneDrive. I think Christopher had sent around some information on the water system. And it shows what that connection is. We'll go up to scale.
Thank you. Looks like Lonnie.
Yes. There. Did you call me, John?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
In a report that was done on this property a couple of years ago, there was reference to a Shell gasoline that the DEC had recognized had been leaching. Is there any concern that has gotten into the aquifer that we may be tapping into? Not sure, even looking at the map, where that is.
So the Shell station is out, I believe, on Route 9. Paradise Lane at the end of that. That's the old Shell station that's out there. That's down gradient from where we are.
So you don't think that's got a chance of getting into the water?
I am not the environmental engineer that did those studies and have not done this. There's another firm, CT Merrill Associates, that has done this.
That's the study I'm looking at.
All right.
So it was unconfirmed, whether or not.
I can't personally comment.
So my question is, the legislator from New Paltz is saying that it may not be a slam dunk for municipal water, and we're hearing that there's possibilities of contamination. What if we couldn't get municipal water, and what if the water is more contaminated than we think?
Well, you're asking me some hypothetical questions that I can't answer without.
Well, the problem is we don't know, and we have this property for $4 million.
I can tell you that we had an existing production well on site that was tested that had only a salt contamination issue with it, a very high yielding aquifer based well. We are pulling from an area further away from that salt contamination. We are significantly upgrading where that Shell station is. They're called an influence on a well when you draw down a well. By state standards, you need 100 foot of protection around that, and we're probably well over a half a mile from that Shell station. So the likelihood that you're going to have a situation where you can't get a water supply with treatment on it on this is next to nothing. I mean, you're going to wind up with being able to put a well in here. As far as the municipal system goes, we just started looking at this for the past month. We've been working on this review now for quite a long time. But the opportunity came up to look for municipal water, and so we just started those investigations. I think before we went into it any further and really pursued anything with the Thruway Authority, we wanted to at least price it out and see if we were looking at a reasonable comparison in cost between one option and the other, and we're at that point. That's about as far as we've gotten so far.
Can I just clarify? You keep saying that the only contaminant is salt, but I think, I'm pretty sure it was the last meeting last month, it was said that there's high, sorry, it was said that there's high iron and manganese as well, which is not as easy to filter out as, let's say, salt.
As I said, we're right now we're looking at both the environmental side of it, the CT Mail working on getting testing done, and we're looking at the municipal side on what we can do on that. So there's additional research that has to be done. We're only about 30% into the design on the whole project. So we do have more work to do to make sure that we have everything figured out for treatment. But all
well, is that true? Are you aware of what?
I am not.
No?
I am not. I have not, but I am not the water engineer. Our water engineering department has looked at that, and they've come up with a system that they believe is what's been estimated in here based on the research that they have.
Legislator Hushkow.
Thank you, Chair Rivers. Have you ever heard of a client opting to drill a well and install the equipment even when there was an opportunity to go into municipal water and the cost was within 10%, which it sounds like this is? Like, is there a reason why we would consider it? Have you ever heard of anyone considering drilling a well when they could have gone into municipal?
Really, it comes down to whether or not you can actually get the water source. And
but like, if we could, would there be any reason to drill the well?
That's a hypothetical question I can't answer for you. That would be up to you.
Well, actually, my question is, have you ever heard of a client doing it in the past?
I
it's
have,
not a hypothetical question.
No, I have not. I have not personally heard of that, no.
This may not be a question for you, but it is water-related. I'm wondering, and maybe someone from the county can answer it, what type of testing we anticipate doing related to the water in advance of final closing on the property, and also how much information we anticipate having from the municipality as it relates to whether or not we would be out of district or in district, and what those costs associated would be. I think, especially as it relates to my first question, I'd be curious the extent of the testing we plan to do and the cost of that testing.
Is that directed at me?
I guess it's directed at whoever can answer it. I'm looking at you only because I think you might be the one who can answer.
Probably cannot answer that.
I think, Tracy, I told you I only got four questions tonight, so we're thinking these are one, right? So the short answer is that we know that with respect to being an out-of-district user, that generally those charges would be about three times the district rate. So we would have to go back and find out what the district rate was. So we know that that's the case. With regard to testing, we would actually have to drill the well to test it. So we know that there's been some testing out there right now. In terms of your due diligence, we have, I believe, 120 days in the contract purchases and sale agreement for due diligence from the date of signing.
But then, if I may,
yeah.
So how extensive are we planning on drilling a well or doing more extensive testing prior in that 120-day period to determine if there any of these concerns are warranted as it relates to municipal water? Because again, it's all going to be relevant to the price. I mean, to legislator, you should tell us a question about why you wouldn't sign up to municipal. I have no point of reference. I'm not a municipal water myself at home, so I don't know. Three times nothing is nothing. Three times.
So the answer to the municipal question is we certainly could get that answer relatively quickly with respect to the municipal question by having the conversation with both the town water district as well as the village supplier, if I can use that. The second piece of that is that should we drill a well? The question goes back to one of the things that John mentioned is we know we have a production well on site that essentially can meet our requirements. It's a high yield well and it has some salt contamination in it. So the question would be to drill the well either before or after, but knowing full well that if we drilled it after and it was a problem, we could always move to the production well in the back.
But if I may, are you saying that the production well only has salt contamination? These other questions about the other potential contamination, we haven't heard a definitive answer on. Are we sure that is the only contamination?
What I can say is from the environmental work that I've looked at, and not without going into any detail, it was clear that the production well could meet the needs of the project that was proposed.
Okay.
feel like you answered a different question.
Yeah, there's enough water. We know there's enough water.
No, I'm not talking about volume. I'm talking about contamination. Well, are we sure that...
That's my sense was, if I can, that I thought that was, I was trying to clear that up, is that the original project as proposed, that the production well was going to be used for that project, so they had a treatment facility that was associated with it. If you go back and look at that environmental work that was there, and it's online, we have copies of it, we can give you, that it shows that they were proposing to use that production well with the treatment facility.
Who, they meaning the previous potential project?
Yeah.
So are you saying that we would be satisfied with a previous project's proposal as it relates to potential contaminants, and we wouldn't want to know what contaminants were in the...
No, I think the testing is there. So we know from the testing that they did what contaminants are in the production well. I think referring this question back to your question, which is that should we drill a well and then test it, to see whether or not it's going to have any salt in it, or versus the fact whether we go through the process and drill the well later. Do we have to drill it within the due diligence period? The answer I would give you is we know we have a water supply that we can fall back on. Whether or not we decide to drill it during the due diligence period, it would be a discussion with the environmental group that's involved.
And the follow on, I guess, then is you're confident based on the previous potential project's work that the only contaminant we need to worry about is salt, and that there's enough. And I don't know the answer to this. I'm just saying, is there any other contaminant we would need to worry about that would have an impact on how we would be required to treat the water, both financially and functionally?
I would go back to the study and look at the study itself that was done, and the water quality work that was done on the original work, before I would be confident to say that the only thing we had to deal with is essentially salt.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Keith.
Thank you. That area has been, you know, developed little pieces here and there, and one of the problems that the town ran into was that they sized their sewer treatment plant just for what was needed, which of course meant immediately, you know, as it started to develop, it needed much more. Have you thought about really thinking ahead and bringing in the village and the town and sizing it for future development, including the proposed government building and anything else we might be added in? I mean, we've heard housing, and then, no, not housing, we've heard, you know, infrastructure for UCAT, and then anything that the town is interested in along South Platte and South Ohio Gulf. Wouldn't it make more sense to do it and then not have to fight with the chance that there could be contaminated water, or we'd have to do an above sewer treatment because there's all water there? So I can't imagine that with the wetlands you could put in an underground septic system.
Well, the only thing that I can talk to you about in this is the on-site septic system design. We are actually at the highest point on the property, and we have greater than 8 feet to groundwater here. We need a minimum of a 4-foot separation, so we have more than enough separation. The soils on the site are actually very good soils for septic systems. They have pretty much the ideal percolation rate. It's a sandy soil that perks not too fast, not too slow. And the building itself doesn't have a high demand. There's some showers and some restrooms in it, but it's not a high demand on the water side or on the wastewater side. So the septic system here is more than adequate. As far as looking at the outside sewer districts and everything else and the potential to tie into that, any long-term projects like that would be years in the making to try to get a modification for the wastewater plant. And while that makes a lot of sense from a global planning perspective, for this project it would be outside of the time frame that would be reasonable in order to bring it online.
Thank you. So just want to make sure I have this clear. So what is the preference? Is the preference to try and link into the municipal water district, or is the preference to do it on site with our own water system?
As an engineer, purely as an engineer, mm-hmm. my recommendation would always be to go with the municipal system over a lower private well.
And so is that what you guys are trying to negotiate now first before we decide if we're going to spend a nickel on a well? I mean, yeah. If that's the preference, right, we should be really, engaged very deeply with the town and village, right? I would think. Is that happening?
So, as I said to you, we just got challenged with trying to come up with costs a week ago. So we've now come to the point, just full circle, almost to the hour today, that we're at reasonable costs and that it makes sense to actually look at the municipal option. So our next step will be just that, to contact the village and the town and to also pursue. We've already made a request to the Thruway Authority to get a meeting set up with them. It's been rather difficult. We're waiting to try to get them. They're not the easiest agency to get to do a quick turnaround on. But we're working on that, and actually, you know, now that we have numbers that seem to make sense, we'll pursue the village and the town also on the water service side of that.
Thank you. Mr. Crystal?
Yeah, this is similar to the question I was going to be asking, which has to do with the well. Would this be just specific to this property, or could it also be used for other purposes if we decide to, you know, whatever we decide to do on that property? Because you had mentioned that the municipal would be an easier connector, I guess, using it for other pieces on the property.
So the well that we would look at for this would just be for this building, and it would be adjacent to the building and the run from that well and the pump site and everything else.
So if we build something else, we'd have to build another well.
You'd build another well, and then also you'd have to look at the area of the site. You know, we know where we are, what we've got around us. We have, you know, control of everything around it. So every one of those would be a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I keep hearing questions about, you know, whether this is superior to that or what's, you know, a better option. I think that that's what these folks have been engaged to do is to, you know, put the finances out there to make the connections. That's what these consultants are here to do, is to come up with what's the best option. I'm not sure that they're here to tell us tonight what's preferable. You know, it's not preferable to, you know, getting municipal water if, you know, we're not going to be added to the, you know, if we're not going to be out of the district, or if we're, you know, not going to be allowed to take the water. You know, it's, I think that this meeting is a little bit micromanaging of the legislature, and B, a little bit premature. And I felt that way. I've expressed that to the chair and to others. I just, you know, I'm listening to the questions, I'm listening to the answers, I'm looking at the presentation, I'm sort of wondering why we're here. Not all of us are here. Some of us are home, but.
Bless you. Thank you. I'm going to go to you, Secretary Joe. I just wanted to get some of these questions because it may be some that you're having. So one of the things that I've noticed that's different from now versus when we were presented this several months ago is the timeline. There was talk of a 2026, 2027 completion, and I remember this distinctly because, and I don't remember the fire chief's name who came to those meetings, but we told him, you know, to be realistic on his expectations, and now it looks like we're...
Bob Consolito.
There we go. We're now at a 2025 in move-in. I mean, that's fantastic, and it's great. I appreciate that we're moving faster. I'm just wondering, is that still is that a realistic timeline, and is the planning process included in this? Because I didn't see that on the timeline.
So two things. I'll go back and double-check. I don't think it was different or not radically different. I think we had given in the earlier presentation a bit of a date. One, and I think it still was tying in more or less to what was shown today. That said, what we're showing today and what we would have shown then too is still kind of a best case scenario. You know, 2026 is entirely possible depending on how things unfold. But this is sort of moving forward without any undue, you know, wrench in time.
Okay. The other thing that I noticed the different is that before we kept on talking about access directly off the thruway. Is that not something we're looking at anymore?
We are, and that's part of why we're reaching out to the thruway. We want to have that discussion with them. That still is something we would like to consider.
Okay, and the concerning thing to me is that, I mean, I'm doing the quick math here, looking at it, this is $1,350 plus a square foot. That, I don't know of any construction project that's going on recently or in the last 10 years that it costs that amount of money, and that's not including the land acquisition cost, that's strictly the construction cost. How are we arriving at those numbers?
So, yeah, keep in mind, it's not your average construction, right? It's the matter that we're looking, you know, in the same way that we're looking to get the redundancy for electric, we have two primary services coming in, redundancy for broadband and all our utilities. In that same kind of way, adding in the generator, you know, adding in the a UPS system, an uninterruptible power supply for our servers. A construction system that is ballistic resistant, you know, not just for the walls, for the windows too. So certainly there are kind of special circumstances given the special nature of the project. And I realize, you know, it is a little bit maybe startling to see, but it's, you know, we've certainly done our part as best we can to, you know, keep this contained as much as possible to what DS needs and NIS needs. And also, you know, we're not looking to be extravagant in terms of neither spaces nor materials, but there's so much that goes in there in terms of structured cabling to all of those dispatch stations. And you know, there's a lot of just infrastructure. It also was noted to me, just let's say in terms of MEP costs, because John's colleague at GPI for mechanical systems also kind of noted when the estimate came in, like, higher than would have been expected. As the estimator just explained to me, some of what is driving that is a bit of kind of just current codes and the efforts to have a more energy conscious system. So that kind of maybe finer level of control for energy, you know, both in terms of getting a better envelope to keep it in, but then also the systems there. They do push up the costs kind of from what you might otherwise expect.
And the last question for me is there any consideration to designing this in two phases so that the PSAP can be done first and as soon as possible? Because to me, and I'm looking at the two gentlemen there who know the most, that's really the major need right now is the PSAP, not the EOC. That, I think, can in theory wait a little bit longer, but you need a place for the dispatchers. And I think if that could be sort of phased into two different parts to this project, I think it's just more advantageous for us. That's really the immediate need is for the dispatchers to have a place that's suitable. I mean, the conditions in the existing place, for those who have not been there, I mean, it's just crazy. I've been involved with EMS 20 years. It's the same 911 center that was there 20 years ago.
Your notes on the existing facilities, I would say absolutely true. In terms of phasing, there was some discussions in terms of how to do. We have made allowances for future expansion because there is the idea that in 30 years' time, they may need additional space. And even if that's the case, even the question came up, should that be sort of built as a shell, even if that's not filled out? I think kind of consensus really was to do this approach. We could go back to that idea. I think in some ways, if that were to work at all, in the long run, I think you certainly would end up spending more money to do that. You know, the near-term costs, maybe you might be able to bring them down, but I think both in terms of their operations and then sort of coming back to do the EOC portion would make it sort of, for lack of a better phrase, I guess, what is it, the penny-wise, pound foolish. You know, that's my own sense.
Well, I'd say pay now or pay more later. A lot more. So there's a significant cost of doing nothing.
Okay. One last thing on water, and then I'll move on to lead into some other questions.
Legislative Maloney was first, then your legislative Green.
There is the DEC, it's on record that there is at least 40 acres, but the way I read the one report, there may be more, but that we know of at least 40 acres of this property that has tested for arsenic, lead, DDT, and Deldrin. And you'll tell me that it's not going to make its way through the sandy soil over there the same way the salt does. But I have a feeling there's more concern about the contamination, which is why we're exploring the municipal. That being said, the original owner's plan with that contaminated soil was to dig it up and put it in a hole on property and put a parking lot over it. What is our plan for the remediation? How much money have we spent on studies so far on remediation and the contamination, and how much do we plan to spend throughout this project? And then I might have a little more.
So I can talk to you a little bit about what the contamination is and how, and what its properties are. And I can tell you a little bit about what our planned remediation is. The contaminations that you're talking about are found in pesticides that are used in orchards, and they're known as heavy metals. Heavy metals are a product that just sits on the surface of the soil and it doesn't leach. It just sits there. Most contamination and you know, Ulster County is full of orchards that have been redeveloped, and so this is not new to the DEC. This is very common for their mitigation. It stays within the first 1, 2, 3 feet of the soil, depending on the concentration. Our plan is based on the studies that CT Mail had done previously, and CT Mail has now been brought in as a consultant to the county. And so Dennis may be able to talk a little bit more about what their cost might be, or Christopher may be. But what we're doing, and it's not that you just put them in a hole and put them on a, under a parking lot. That's one option for your mitigation. Mitigation for these soils is really to stockpile them in berms or under pavement or other areas of the site, and then put a cover over them. And the cover is nothing more than a 4 to 6 inch layer of topsoil and seeded in grass. So we have berms that we need to do on this project. We're using berms as a way to do protection for the building. So I think I had mentioned before that we need an 82-foot separation. It's 82 or 85, I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's in the 80s. Separation between our building and the closest accessible road. And within that 80-some-odd feet, we're also planning on doing berming so that cars can't just crash into the building. And so the soil that we're going to pull, we're going to use to create those berms. And they're going to be kept right on site and managed on site. Anything in excess of that, we have another area behind, back towards the power lines or behind us, that we're planning on using to also pick any other soil that if we had to, and soil it there and seed and topsoil that too.
What about a cost?
The cost estimate was included in the numbers that Christopher has looked at already. We put some initial budgets to that.
Yeah.
So we're going to do all that in less than $200,000. We're just going to dig up 40 acres of...
No. We're not remediating the entire site.
Okay, we're going to leave it.
So we had extensive conversations with the DEC, and you're allowed to divide the site up into units and remediate the portion of the site that you're developing. And they're happy with that. And CT Mail is going to lead that, or has begun to lead that effort. They've done, as you're well aware, they've done extensive studies on the site. This particular part of the 57 acres is actually the least, or one of the least contaminated portions of the entire property. The methodologies for remediation depend on the kinds of uses that are going to occur on the site. So in other words, housing or single family housing is a much bigger issue, and there's much greater concern about where soils are stockpiled and how they are covered or remediated. In this case, it's effectively an office building site. So the budget does include, the construction budget in the site work or earthwork does include the removal, stockpile, and cover of the contaminated soils on this 6 acre portion, not the entire site. And the consultant's budget includes CT Mail's work.
Okay. So when I see the scoring matrix that was done to decide that this was the best location for this project, I see that you scored Paradise Lane the second highest as far as positive environmental screen. So of all the different properties we looked at, this was basically looked at as a positive, good environmental situation. I'm just confused with all these things I'm hearing about water, contamination, arsenic, lead, that you guys ended up just edging this Golden Hill out on the scoring matrix with a really high environmental score.
So let me first talk about Golden Hill. Golden Hill did not...
No, let's talk about the high environmental score. What would it take?
Well,
I'm just trying to answer your question.
Okay.
So if you bear with me for just a second.
Golden Hill did rank very high. We liked Golden Hill. The problem with Golden Hill is that it's already in use, and it has a cost in there that we really couldn't capture, and that cost is if we were going to use that site, it would have been the adaptive reuse of the existing building. We looked at other options to do other things on the site. They really didn't play out. So the adaptive reuse would have been, first of all, there's an expense for reusing a building. It's difficult to do that, especially for this type of building. But then you also have uses in those buildings right now, and you'd have to find a new home for them. And there's a cost associated with that. As far as the remediation on Paradise Lane, we did take a very hard look at the remediation that we're talking about here, and that is primarily the pesticides in the top foot to 3 feet, 4 feet of soil. It's a very common thing in Ulster County, in any orchard rip mitigation. We're already in a brownfield program here. The site itself and the remediation, after doing extensive discussions with CT Mail and the DEC, turned out to be something that was very reasonable for this quality of a piece of property with its proximity to the thruway, its proximity to redundant power, which is very, very important for this, the redundancy of Central Hudson Power in either direction, the redundancy of communications. It's one of the few areas
The question was specifically about the scoring, and you scored it as no mitigation, just under almost a perfect score. Below it was some mitigation necessary. Had you scored it lower, Golden Hill would have scored higher, and you would have come to us with Golden Hill as the number one property. I'll never understand, and you haven't said anything right here to make me understand, that how you scored this so high environmentally with all of these issues.
I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because I don't know what version of the scoring sheet you have. I don't know what the date on it is. I know that after we did an initial
5/20/2022.
Right, so that was more than, that was a year ago. We did additional work over the summer, and I think there was one that was issued to this body in October of last fall.
Did you lower the environmental score then?
I think we did because of the fact that we had to do some mitigation. And at that time, by the way,
but everything was out there. All these reports, CT Mail report that you referred to, that was all out there when this was originally scored. But by the time you changed your environmental score, we were already honing in on this parcel.
Well, I can tell you
that. How we found this parcel that wasn't on the market at the time. So many questions. My colleague before said this is premature. We don't know if we have access to the thruway, where we're getting our water. This question's to me about this remediation. Seems like we're not premature whatsoever.
If I could just make one or two notes. Access to the thruway would be terrific. I know that Everett would love to have that. It's not a requirement. You know, if you want to look at Golden Hill, because you want to compare them, Golden Hill has the one road up, one road down. You know, it's off now, but by this one, we've got the two ways out. You know, these are the kind of things that make some of the differences, aside from just the scoring and the numbers. The other one, I lost your other second point.
Yeah. Well, the question was about the environment. This is literally a brownfield, and it was scored high. It beat out 8 or 9 other properties, tied for second as far as environmental screening. I'll never understand a lot about this. How much we paid, how we found it.
Let's do green.
Thank you. Let's see. I'll just put my questions out and then you can answer them. The first thing is that I have a request for greenhouse gas inventory on the construction and the operation of this project, and I think that that's a fair request. It doesn't have to be done tonight, but I would like to include that information. And I think that whenever we're investing county money moving forward, we should make that request. But my specific question is, what, if any, fossil fuel is going to be burned for various uses on the property? And then my other, there was mention of solar on some of the open space, and I haven't heard that mentioned tonight. And why it's especially important for this project is because of the reliability. if you put solar with battery backup and the grid goes down, you don't have to use, for example, what my town just purchased, a very expensive diesel generator. So those are my questions and requests.
Sure.
Thank you.
I might ask Rick to come up to follow up on this, but if I can just do a few of those to answer. Fossil fuel burning, the only one we're looking to do, in fact, is a diesel generator. We do need, just in terms of regulations for what's required for this type of space, we do need a generator, and we will have then a diesel generator. But that's our only fossil fuel. We are using the geothermal wells for heating and cooling, and there is the PV array. In terms of... sorry, I think I lost your own.
Well, in terms of the greenhouse gas inventory, we can do that on the construction systems at some point. And I'm sure we'll be able to prepare something with respect to building operations. The building is going to be constructed with insulated concrete form walls, steel frame roof, lots of insulation on the roof. We chose ICF with a lengthy study of options in consultation with Palumbo. It's very similar to the New Paltz Fire Station, and it's ballistics resistant and ultra energy efficient and resilient to storms and an earthquake and such. Obviously, concrete and EPS do have a higher global warming potential than wood, which wouldn't be practical for this use because of the ballistics resistance. We are using geothermal or ground source heat pump, heating and cooling, energy recovery, ventilation for a healthy indoor environment. Obviously, it'll be ultra energy efficient lighting, which is a minimal load. The building is going to be loaded with electric demand. The building enclosure itself and the operating systems are not the big heavy users. It's the servers, it's the radio equipment, it's the 24/7, 365 answering center. And that's really going to be the big energy hog. The budget that Trophy Point put together, and I assume you're going to get the whole thing if you haven't gotten it already, does include a $150,000 allowance for rooftop solar. We're thinking, based upon, and this is from the electrical engineer, ultimately the total area of solar that would be needed is something like half an acre. I could be wrong. It might be an acre of actual solar needed if we want this building to be, you know, net zero. And it does have, the budget does include a large UPS system in the budget, which you could in some way say is attributable to the equipment and not the building, but either way, it's taxpayer money. We've also, I shouldn't say we, Christopher and the county have had conversations with the two battery manufacturers that are going to iPark 87. We're going to future-proof the building for additional battery storage. Whether that gets done when the building opens or some years later, the building will be set up so it can be done.
Thank you.
And that'll be partially, you know, dealing with the greenhouse gas impacts, but it's really, from an economic perspective, it's going to shave demand, peak demand charges, which will be important. I was just thinking about the cost of water and municipal water. Our office building, which is on Main Street in New Paltz, we have about 20 occupants. Now, it's not 24/7. But our water and sewer charges are about $30-some dollars a month. Now, this will also be an ultra-water-efficient building. We're talking about high-efficiency toilets, faucets, and some showers. Clearly, when EOC is in operation, you have a lot of people there. is going to be more, but you won't have sewer charges because there's going to be a septic on site if you use municipal water. I can look up what the gallon usage is, and we can ask the plumbing engineers to come up with a reasonable budget based upon our charges.
I want to go back to the solar quickly. The type of system and inverters that are spec'd out here, is that the type that can pump into the grid and achieve a net zero outcome, or is it the type that can pump into the building when the grid is down?
With battery storage, it can go into the building where the battery is there.
And it'll refill the battery. If the grid goes down for 6 months, we would be able to run the building on solar.
Not with just the amount of solar on the roof. We would also need the ground mount and batteries. It's been a lot of batteries in that case.
Right.
But if you set up the systems correctly, the generator can charge the batteries and then shut off, like in the winter, for example.
Because I do really believe that we need to prepare for long-term power outages in the future.
Well, part of the reason, the main reason that this site came up to the top is the redundant utility services. Two Verizon feeds, Crown Castle from two directions. Is that correct? Is it called Crown Castle? And Central Hudson from two directions. And none of the other sites have all of those features.
Do you know of any other call centers? But it was just to that exact point. I was just going to ask a quick question.
Okay, several people have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a beautiful design you got here. How did you come up with the design? Did the county give you specs on this, or did you give them a choice, one, two, or three, and were you just threw it on your own? No, the building itself. Grass is good, too.
It's an ongoing process. You know, first we just had to mass things out and work out our floor plans, work out how we work on the site. In terms of you know, finishes and so on, that we're still going through. That's part of our design development phase.
So this ain't the final product.
In terms of our actual materials, we know, and we're going to use the ICF structure, for example. So you know, that's a decided thing.
Planning is decided.
Yeah,
the floor plan is fixed.
Wouldn't it be more cost efficient and maybe even more energy efficient, Manna, if they use two floors instead of one spread out?
We consider energy. If we go with two floors, we need more floor space just for our elevators, our stairs. There's additional equipment that goes in there too. It's something we had considered when we were thinking about Golden Hill, because one of Golden Hill's options was to try and do multi-story there. But it was one that we kind of knew would not necessarily work, at least in terms of your construction costs.
Two floors, elevators, all that stuff.
Is there any way, I mean, you guys looked at this, you did a good job making the presentation, you have everything detailed, but if I was building a new house or I was doing work for a client, the one thing that would come up is, how could we save money? How could we save money?
So, I mean, part of that, of course, is getting in the estimates, right? You know, when we were sort of first doing that back in October, it was, you know, there wasn't any kind of fine grain to it. You know, going into this, I think it's written up in our narratives, which may not have been shared, but, you know, there's two to three things we're trying to hit here, right? Whether we're talking our skin on the outside, whether we're talking the material from the inside. One, we want it to be durable. The idea is that this is a building that can last, you know, 50, 7,500 years. So durability is key, right? Second thing, though, is, you know, and let's say low maintenance, too. We don't want to sort of be picking up things that might last forever, but just have high maintenance costs. But, of course, cost is another one. We're not looking, you know, if we're going to be spending money, it's going to be on the point of that durability, right? We're not looking to run costs up. Now that we're getting in our cost estimates, now we can start to really, you know, pick it a little closer and think, well, hold on, you know, should we look and reconsider our material here or there? That's completely open. But that, again, it's the whole iterative process of this as we go forward with design development. You can take a look. You know, so value engineering is certainly a possibility, but not really until we had our cost estimates, our first cost estimates.
Chair Bartels.
Thank you. So I have a couple questions I just want to pull up. In Trophy Point's document, it leads with what the exclusions are, and some of the exclusions I see elsewhere in here, like the construction manager fees, that's included under professional services. And so I have, if I can, I just have a few questions. So construction management is listed under professional fees, and that's already contract for 419. That takes us through the end of construction, I'm assuming. So that's a set cost that's done. Okay. Construction contingency, it says it's not included in Trophy Point's budget. Is it included somewhere else, construction contingency?
Check.
And then while you're checking, that, just on that point, it says project labor agreements aren't included in Trophy Points, and I don't see them anywhere in here. Are we anticipating project labor agreements, and what would be the anticipated cost or the upcharge for that? Are we expecting to see an increase based on project labor agreements?
I mean, PLAs aren't going to incur a cost. They're going to, it's a decision on the county on whether or not we're going to see a benefit from it or not.
Be a reduction in cost.
If we're not going to see a saving with a PLA, then we won't go with a PLA.
Okay.
Predominantly.
Okay. And on that,
Dennis looks like he wants to correct me on that.
No, I don't. I just want to compliment on the chair on that question, because I think one of the things that we've done in the past for large capital projects, we've done what they call a PLA study,
mm-hmm.
to understand what savings would be available for us with the PLA. That mm-hmm. probably should be done here.
Yeah. Okay. And as far as the construction contingency, since Trophy Point made the point that it's an exclusion. I mean, I saw contingency in lines.
There's a design contingency, which...
That's design, because that's really different than we lived through construction contingencies and change orders in a previous project here. So we just want to make sure that it exists somewhere in the budget, right?
Well, so my experience with Palumbo, and they're not in the room,
mm-hmm.
but when they get a hold of this, each division will have a contingency in their estimate of this project. And they work very hard to protect the owner's interests. And you work with them on the family court, and I don't know what else, and the conversion of the school to Ulster Community College in the city of Kingston. They're very good.
I appreciate that, is it normal not to have construction contingency allotted for in cost estimates on construction?
No, the opposite. And I'll answer that right now. That's the opposite. It's 10% minimum, 15% is standard for to have both design and construction contingencies, especially major projects like this. That is the minimum is 10% should be in there.
It is for the design. The design contingency is in at 15%.
Right. No, and design contingency is provided for. But again, in Trophy Points, I'm just looking at their document, which says their estimate notes assumptions state exclusions, soft cost, design fees, construction contingency, owner change order reserve, construction manager fees, markups or general conditions, project labor agreements, excavation, soil remediation, asbestos abatement. We know that's not applicable.
They did carry an escalation fee. In there, if you look at the next page, you can see there's an escalation fee for construction at 8.5% to mid-May 24. You're correct. We should have a conversation about it.
Yeah, I'm just concerned because I haven't seen it before, and it obviously, when you talk about these numbers, that's a significant cost. So
the original cost that we gave did carry a 13% construction contingency, as I recall.
But if this doesn't, we may need to add 13% to this.
I don't see it in here either. Thank you.
Okay. And then my other question, just for clarification, just to understand, for the EOC portion of the building, and maybe this is probably a question for Everett, how often, and even looking backward, how often does that portion of the building get utilized? You know, the other portion, 24/7, 365.
So currently the way we're set up, we're not set up in a very good way. Our PSAP and our EOC are in two separate locations, and it just doesn't work out. So if we're going to activate the EOC, it becomes very hard to manage because we don't know what's going on up at the 911 center. We don't have the connection. We don't have our fingers really on the pulse of what's going on. So when we built, when we designed this, we designed it to where the EOC and the PSAP are adjacent to each other, so we can do that. With that, you would see, you know, we do advanced monitoring, enhanced monitoring, often during storms. We would do that in the EOC now rather than in the PSAP, okay, where our deputy director, Mike Dennis, the emergency manager, he would bring in himself, probably Central Hudson, NYSEG, some other utility companies, and we would be in a, you know, what would we say, level two, enhanced monitoring, and for a normal storm. So you would see the use of that EOC go up drastically. But as of right now, it becomes very, very hard to do that on a daily basis.
So, I mean, I appreciate that this design is more functional, obviously, and would because of the functionality would incur more usage. But currently, how often are you standing up an EOC?
So last year we stood up the EOC four times for incidents. That was based off of because we don't have the functionality. It becomes very hard to manage more than two separate locations.
And I imagine, but you can correct me, that when you talk about extending it for the kind of functionality you're talking about, where you would stand it up in advance of storms, there's a range of usage you use it for. In a major emergency, you have all the agencies and every one of those seats might be filled.
Yes.
And in an event like you're talking about, or in the preparation of a potential storm event, you might just have a few.
We had, based off of all the reports, this past storm that we had was going to be, you know, 8 to 10 inches here in Kingston, you know, 2 plus feet out in Shandaken. So as a county as a whole, we had legitimate concerns, right? We didn't see all that, but we were at a level 2. We had NYSEG, we had Central Hudson, we had State Police, the Sheriff's Office, Dishes, obviously Ulster County, we had Finance in there, we had OFA in there, we had DSS in there, Red Cross, right? That's kind of like the minimum operation-wise. And then if you had a catastrophic event, such as like a trail derailment or something like that, you know, it's going to be a lot larger. You look at Landon, we were stepping on each other. It was very, very hard to operate. You know, we were using the three rooms around the EOC. We took over the sheriff's training room. We took over the sheriff's lineup room. We took over both conference rooms upstairs. We took over a lot of area for that 5-day activation.
And how many people during Landon, how many people would you say on average were present?
So that room, I believe 17 seats in the EOC. Every seat was full. And then I would say we had 30 plus on a daily activation. And this is built for 33.
Okay, thank you.
City Keel.
Thank you. So I'm just going to go back to the very beginning of this and where we saw the pie chart with different colors. And it looked like we're about a third of the way through. And 30%, I think you said there's 30% of the design phase completed, yet the cost seemed to have gone up about, you know, $10 million from what the estimate. And I'm not holding you guys to that estimate. I'm just saying, from our point of view, the cost estimate went from just under $10 million. So of that remaining 70%, how much of that will do you foresee, or if you can estimate, will increase the cost of the construction and the design and construction, I guess, is really what I'm asking.
Sure, sure. One, in terms of the increase, and two, in terms of anticipation. You know, the county has asked, originally we were kind of asked, hey, what are we talking about in terms of site, you know, just so we could compare sites and equalizing them. And then, of course, from there, estimate for the actual construction. And that's what we had shared earlier on. But as we went on, you know, clearly there's a lot more to this project, wherever it would be built, a lot more to it than just the land and the building itself and kind of site work, as I say, with all that kind of equipment going in. And so we you know, over the last few months, been taking a you know, closer look at what's involved there and you know, talking with Motorola, talking with Verizon, figuring out the structural cabling and so on. So, as I say, you know, numbers are up. The kind of overall construction costs actually, were, as I say, kind of remarkably held true. But it's trying to get the whole picture because clearly, like no one, right? I know from before in your past experience, nobody here wants surprises, right? And so the county has asked us, like, let's take a look at everything and try and count as best we can. So we've certainly done a much closer look at things. From going from this 30% to getting to 100% documents, I would say there's nothing necessarily expected to run those up. It's not as if, like, well, we're 30% here, so we by the time we're done, it's going to be three times this amount. You know, clearly, it doesn't work that way. As we go and we get those sort of better decisions and know, you know, more specifically in terms of a material here and a size and takeoff there, numbers certainly could change. You know, whether it's, oh, you know what, we're going to need to raise the roof up by a foot because we have the clearances at the bottom, and now suddenly we've got, you know, whether it's that, or whether it's, let's do a little bit of value engineering to you know, keep the cost down as best as we can. So could kind of go either way. And again, we'll have the, with Plumber Group, we're going to have that checkpoint at the 60% and the 90% spot so that we can see, are we staying on track? You know, or you know, is it getting worse? Are we getting better? Could go either way, as I say.
So,
but I certainly wouldn't, I'm not expecting, you know, anything to radically change. I think we've got, apart from the Verizon question mark, I think we've got pretty much everything present and accounted for. But
so there's nothing in the 70% that has not been designed yet that would specifically potentially drive up the overall cost that you can think of?
I mean, you know, when they get to the 60% phase, there will be more specifics for them to work with. So in that sense, even if you know, it's not like let's bring on extra scope, but we'll have a clearer picture and more focus on what is there. So you know, at the moment we know about that UPS system, so that their power never goes out on critical equipment. You know, we have a number, sort of a reasonable number for that. But you know, 30% further into this process, we'll have a you know, more specific idea. What's our basis of design manufacturer? What is the size exactly? And with that, again, we can get better numbers. But I'm not expecting anything to kind of wildly swing either way.
Well, no, not from the building and not from the equipment other than Verizon. But if we, the county, decides we want to...
You come to the mic, though.
That's all right. If we want to buy a battery backup system, that's going to cost money. If we want to do the additional ground mount solar array, that will cost money. That said, there may be incentives and other forms to offset that cost, and we haven't explored those in detail. But the building will operate without those, and it'll operate well.
Let's say Levine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions, and forgive me if this information was provided somewhere on the online, but I just didn't have a chance to kind of find it. I know the question before was brought up regarding the generator capacity that, you know, the diesel generator that's being proposed. Would it be possible just to kind of get an idea of how long that's kind of going to be anticipated to last before it runs out, you know, if it's got a finite diesel capacity.
Pretty certain 70, 72 hours over there.
Are you talking about the operation of the generator itself?
Yes. No,
the fuel storage.
Well, the fuel storage, yes. For how long is the building going to be able to be running on the generator before it's, not going to be having, before it's still off the grid and it's running on generator power?
Yeah, I think it was 72 hours.
I think 72 hours is what we were talking about before, yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. And another question I had was in regards to, I know it was, talked about the building materials, for the walls and the ballistic, glass and such. Do we know at this point, what the building will be rated for in terms of, withstanding, a tornado or something of that nature, an EF1 tornado? Would this, do we know what the building's rated for to be able to take, a significant wind or storm event, how strong are we talking about?
It's going to be made of reinforced concrete.
Reinforced concrete and steel. And there is a NFPA standard for PSAPs, and the structural engineers are aware of it. If you look at some of the images of hurricane devastation in Florida, the buildings, many of the buildings that are standing were built of insulated concrete form. So this will be built to withstand tornadoes and
earthquakes.
Yes. Yes, definitely earthquakes, yes. Okay. I don't remember the class and but the highest class of rating, yes.
Thank you. And so just one final question I had in regards to, kind of looking at the schematics of the plan, of the property and such. My question is, was it ever discussed, or is there a potential down the line to put in for some type of emergency shelter for folks? I know this property is fairly large, and I'm hoping that, God forbid, some type of natural disaster occurs. I know a number of the municipalities, have been trying to do, emergency sheltering and, senior centers or village halls. But, I mean, this a project of this size, I think, with what it's going to be connected to, I feel like for the increasing numbers we're seeing of natural disasters and issues where people are going to be needing potentially emergency sheltering, is that a potential that's going to be feasible on this property going forward at some point?
I can answer that. It's a good question. We normally would not set up a shelter at a location where our POC is active or PSAP is active. Reason is during an incident, that area is going to get very, very busy. And then to bring in a shelter location is not feasible. And we would want to set them up for the municipalities. So we have identified in our sheltering plan locations throughout the county where we could activate shelter locations with the assistance of Red Cross. And we would continue on that procedure.
I appreciate that. And I understand the issues of potentially having it located in the same building, but I was just wondering about the feasibility of, this large. And forgive me for asking if this question's been answered before, but on the schematic design here, the proposed lot of 5.95 acres, there's no proposal for that at this point. That's kind of just that's south of the parking lot that's kind of blocked off. Is there an idea for this, the proposed 5.95 acres?
Sorry, I'm not seeing a specific sheet, but very, very quickly, we're trying to take from the full lot kind of all that we need, the minimum amount in terms of getting the ground to the building, getting the setbacks, getting the parking areas in there, go on, but otherwise we'll see what try to kind of leave off for other choices and other uses. The rest, there is on that plan, I'm not sure how well to call that, but to the left, to the west of the parking lot, there's a plan for a future storage building, a Butler building.
I see that. Yeah.
And then also south from the parking lot is the idea of having a bit of a staging area.
That's what I think I was referring to.
That's the 5.9.
So
Okay, sorry, yeah. So on the idea that, like, if the state perhaps is kind of giving, you know, some assets that might be deployed for emergencies, the emergency service department wants to be able to have a place to receive those and
I think it's a notation for the site itself is 5.5.
That's correct. I appreciate your answers on those questions. Thank you.
Legislator Maloney?
Yeah, I was wondering how many of the other sites we looked at have dual trunk lines? Did any of them? How many of the other sites we looked at, 9 or 10, how many of them had multiple trunk lines?
For Verizon?
Verizon, yeah. There was the on the Esopus site, we were able to bring the Highland site at 299 9W was a site that they could bring it in.
Well, it wasn't quite there, as I recall, but it was within kind of shooting distance.
Yeah, they were going to be able to bring it in there. There was infrastructure build out. And then...
Look, a lot of counties around the state have built state-of-the-art 911 centers recently. I think Dutchess County have. How many surrounding counties and other counties around the state have dual trunk lines at their new state-of-the-art?
So I can look into that and see how many actually have it. I know that, you know, Dutchess County is looking to build out a new facility, and dual trunk lines is what they're looking for to do that as well. What's that?
Something they're talking about.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, the 911 center is the central nervous system of emergency response. If someone cannot call 911 and ask for assistance, then assistance isn't going to get to them. So ensuring that the 911 system stays up and running continuously is essential to the operation.
They've functioned pretty well. How did we find this site here? It wasn't on the market. Who brought us this location?
So we were aware of the site in New Paltz from other opportunities that we had looked at, and from the fact that there was an ongoing development process. And so when we started to look at areas where we were looking at, we looked at a lot of sites that weren't on the market. And this site came up as one of the sites that we may want to explore. And at the time when we started that exploration, it became much more robust in terms of our looking at the site, and we went as far as essentially to contact the
owner. So it popped into your head specifically?
I don't think it popped into my head. I think it was actually in within the team looking at the site. It's always been a development site that was underutilized in the town of New Paltz. It's been through a number of different development proposals.
Never got through. I don't suffer to get through any secret process. It was the village and town.
Yeah,
pretty much shut everything down for environmental reasons, which now seem to be pretty easy. We just make mounds of pesticides.
It was a different scale. And on that note, I think it's important that the legislature know that we had approached the town of New Paltz relative to something called a balancing of public interest test. The balancing of public interest test allows us as a county to claim immunity from the local zoning statute.
Recently done?
Yes.
Last night?
I don't think it was last night, no. So as the county declared itself lead agency with respect to SEAKER on the resolution with respect to the site, we went back to the town of New Paltz, and they indicated to us that there was no objections to the county becoming lead agency. We then made a presentation to the town relative to the balance of public interest test. They held a public hearing on that. Actually had two meetings on that, and the second one was a public hearing. They have now, as a board, by resolution, have decided that the county can claim immunity from the local zoning statute. So from an approval standpoint, at a local planning board standpoint,
the county is now essentially in the driver's seat relative to not having to go to the community with respect to worrying about local zoning or local land use approvals. So the county will be making its own determination under SEAKER. And moving forward on that, the county could then begin, because we issue our own building permits, the county could essentially begin to develop the site. We want to make sure that we go back to the community and continue to update them on what we're doing on the site. We've made that promise to them. But we do have a resolution and a decision from the town of New Paltz relative to the balance of public interest.
So we've removed the layer of jurisdiction, and the people of New Paltz now have really no ability to put up much of a fight, no matter what we come across with regards to water remediation. One last question, and I'm not sold. I've said it before, there are lots of concerns with residents in Highland and New Paltz about cancer clusters and other things. I'm not sold that it is safe to just put these mounds of dig up a little bit, make some mounds of these lead and arsenic and all this. Has anyone working for the consultants or involved in this process whatsoever, have any of them ever done work for the present owner of Paradise Lane, former or present owner?
CT Mail has been there. CT Mail. Oh, I turned it off. So CT Mail did all of the studies to date for the present owner, and what else?
Anybody else?
And we have.
You
we
have
did
too.
We did some studies.
So everybody involved has worked for the owner that we just.
They have
$4 million.
No. Just me. We did some designs for Wildberry Lodge, which he then said not doing.
Was it you or anyone else? Maybe it wasn't planning or the county. Was anybody maybe? Did you have anything to do with, hey, I got this property? It really was just, we still don't know where it came from, but somebody came.
I recall it. I thought the county exec brought it up. Pat Ryan.
Was that right before or right after the thousands of dollars in donations that came into his congressional campaign? I wonder if that's just a question.
Let's
I'll throw out here.
I don't know.
All right. Let's hit it quick, Bob.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly go back to our conversation about cost savings and understand a little bit more about your bidding process for materials and such.
What's the question?
The question is, do you get multiple bids for materials, and how does it, like, do you have a minimum number that you get?
Well, so it's public works, so any qualified bidder is going to bid on the project. You know, it's going to be publicly noticed.
For a given material, let's say, we'll be giving a set of three, let's say, options that we consider acceptable.
That's what I was asking.
Correct.
Okay.
So on the specifications, when the construction documents are complete, if the specifications call for a specific material, let's say it's an exterior cladding, you can't say only Owens Corning. You have to say this, or similar, and then the contractor submittals to the design team for approval.
I guess what I'm asking is, like, is there going to be a Cadillac version of desks? Is there going to be, like, a general version of desks, and then is there going to be, like, the less expensive version? Are there going to be options? Or are they going to be all? Is it all the highest end stuff? That's what I'm going for.
I think if we're talking about the desks, he's got.
I'm talking in general, in the things that we're purchasing.
In terms of the construction, no.
Let's hear Chris. I'll sort of, from my experience, answer your partial question. I think I know what you're asking. They give you what the specifications of the design is, and then the materials have to fit within that classification. There is a way to do what I think you're looking to do, which is to ask for the contractors who bid to give you a price on that meets the specification, but then also value engineer so they can give you an alternate option. And then, of course, our consultants and engineers would have to evaluate it. Would it meet our needs? And is this something that we could substitute? So
that's exactly what I'm asking. Like, if I was going to personally go and buy a desk, I would look at three different options. I would look for the very fancy one, and I would look for the one that I can just put a piece of paper on and do my work on. And I would probably pick the something in between there. You know, so that's what I'm looking at. Are we looking at options that are across the board, or have we just decided you know, that we're going on one level.
Keep in mind that when it goes out, you know, the contractor will then just, in all of those cases, pick the cheapest one. So we, on our side, want to pick three items that we think are all relatively equal and, you know, adequate for the job. So, you know, the closer band. But
I know it might sound chintzy of me, but those kind of costs really add up. And so I just wanted to hear that process. Thank you.
So this building requires a certain level of quality. And so we've done a pretty thorough alternatives analysis with respect to the building enclosure. The building is going to have ground source heat pump heating and cooling. Would it be cheaper to do air source heat pump heating and cooling up front? Yes. It won't be as resilient, it won't last as long, and it's not ballistics resistant. So yes, it's going to cost a lot more to do ground source than it would be to do air source, but the building is going to be much more durable, much more resilient, will last longer, and will cost less to operate. The ICF system is not going to cost more than the various layers of systems to get the same energy efficiency and ballistics resistance. We found that out on multiple projects. As far as the actual equipment that's going into the building, there's a certain level that they have to meet to operate properly. And I'm leaving it up to emergency management to be able to dictate that. We're not putting that out. As far as the finishes are actually going to be the least cost aspect of the project. Most of the exterior of the building is going to be some form of synthetic stucco with some other finishes. It will have a metal roof, which is going to be highly durable, last a long time, resistant to storms, and will allow us to easily mount solar, if so be it. So yes, there are, you know, maybe extra costs up front, but they will allow the building to operate much better, be more resilient, be ballistics resistant, et cetera. So there's certain things that we have to do here that you might not do at, like, our office building. We have air source heat pump. We don't have ground source, you know, yet. Does that make sense?
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that full explanation. Thanks.
Thank you. So one technical request, and that is the photovoltaic estimate that's included in Trophy Point's document doesn't reference the kilowatt size of the system. It just says photovoltaic system. So if someone could find out what kilowatt rating they utilize to come up with that number, that would be great. And then, you know, to follow on Legislator Criswell's comment and to just echo a little bit of the concern about the cost related to the furniture, but I just want to up front say, in no way am I suggesting that we bring any furniture that we currently have over. I'm saying that the numbers give me a little bit of a concern. I'm asking that we get more than one quote, which I would assume when it comes closer, and that we think seriously about, I realize it's one space, but the usage that you've defined for the PSAP space is very different than the usage for the EOC space in terms of the amount of hours in a day that the equipment's being used and the amount of days in a year that the equipment's being used. And just looking at the detail, the EOC furniture alone is $300,000. I don't have the answer. I haven't done the deeper dive, so I don't know what new furniture that isn't by this specialty company, but that might serve a need when addressing it out against the amount of hours that is being used in a day, what that differential might look like. And we have a lot of time before that comes up, obviously. But I would urge that, one, that we get multiple quotes, that we potentially even go out to bid, and that in the interest of the final cost, that we think of those two spaces differently, potentially, because of the amount of use that they get.
That's understood. We have been doing a lot of research on furniture for the PSAP and EOC. We've talked to multiple companies when it comes to that type of furniture. Watson, Russ Bassett, Zybex, which is the quote you saw. So we have been doing our due diligence with all that, and we will continue to do that.
Again, especially as it relates to EOC furniture, I think I would think too beyond specialty furniture. Like, really, again, I'm talking new furniture, but beyond EOC furniture, because if those are desks that are going to be used X number of times per year rather than 24 hours per day, there might be very nice new furniture that you could get at a fraction of the cost because it's not specialty EOC furniture. So that's, again, I just would hope that we consider.
Thank you.
Mr. Rock?
Thanks. I'm hearing a lot of conversation about furniture. Now I've heard a lot of conversation about furniture prior to tonight. To Legislator Bartels' point, with all due respect, the EOC furniture, while not used for many hours per year, is typically going to be used for many hours in a row by the same people. So I think that that's one of the concerns about using the specialty furniture in the EOC, is that, you've got people who are going to be in that room for, 12, 24, 36, 72 hours, depending on the state of the emergency. And, you want them to be not, breaking their backs and whatnot while they're sitting there. One of the reasons that, to Legislator Criswell's point, I understand the desire to save money. I'm concerned about, having like a 1, 2, and 3, level on furniture for the PSAP, because, that's used 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. These people who are working there are fielding multiple emergencies at once, speaking to multiple agencies at a time, while working 12 and 24 hour shifts. There's a reason why the furniture is expensive. It's not because we like to light money on fire. I really think that, having these spaces be ergonomically, beneficial to our dispatchers while they're trying to do an impossible job. Right now, they're still doing it in an impossible space with impossible furniture. But, I would like that to be a part of the conversation. I've heard a lot of conversation tonight about dollars and cents, which is important because obviously this is a Ways and Means Committee meeting. But, we have to remember that there are emergency dispatchers, behind these conversations that are going to have to do a very hard job. Show of hands. Has anybody in the room not been to visit our dispatch center? I know that Legislator Hansett is on Zoom with us. She and I are very interested in encouraging anybody who has not visited the 911 center. We're going to try and set up another visit to the 911 center. Not only will you get to see what goes on there, you'll get to meet our dispatchers and see the kind of circumstances that they're currently operating in. And I think that might change at least a couple of minds on, the haste or lack of haste that we're seeing from some legislators on this project.
Mr. Ron, when you're setting that up, just be mindful of the capacity. No more than 3 legislators at a time.
Well, again, that right there should say it all, shouldn't it? We've got to go in and in waves.
Yeah, it's a small space. Legislator Cale.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that I think that we've gone over that already, that we are all in favor of creating a new, safe, more ergonomically friendly place for the 911 dispatchers who do have a terrible job. It's very difficult. Very difficult to sit there for those long hours and field all those multiple tasks at one time. It's a very hard job. And so I think that we've already established that we're in favor of building a new 911 center, government operations center, right? We do have a responsibility, though, to make sure that the costs are reasonable, right? I mean, that's been any discussion that we've been involved in from the very beginning has been in relation to the cost, not to the necessity of it,
not into the desire to make it modern and comfortable for the 911 dispatchers. It's never been that discussion. It's always been about the cost to the taxpayer.
I totally agree that the conversation has been almost entirely about the cost to the taxpayers. And I've spent, the better part of 15 years and 3 months here, discussing various projects about the cost to the taxpayers. One of my concerns is that we passed the site, we passed a resolution authorizing the chair to sign a contract for the site in, I want to say it was November, if somebody can correct me if I'm wrong on that. Was it? I think it was November. Here we are, we're in March. The chair's had the purchase and sale agreement for almost a month now. This meeting is another meeting that, has the entire legislature invited to it, that it was preceded by a meeting that leadership and the leadership of the Ways and Means Committee were invited to discuss costs. Almost none of these costs, save the water, none of the cost increases that we've discussed tonight have had to do with the site costs, except for the water, which is somewhat, an increase of the site costs. Right now, what I'm hearing here is we're micromanaging furniture purchases. Before we even have signed the contract on the purchase and sale agreement of the land. I've been in the legislature for almost 16 years. I've never, not once, and there have been, I want to say, 10 major projects that the county's taken on, including, the Sophie Finn Elementary, the family court. I've never sat in this room or across the hall or in any room to discuss whether or not we need furniture or how much the furniture should cost or what level of furniture we should buy for a building. Typically we budget what we allow the executive to spend, and then the executive and their staff and our consultants go and do the work. Here we are, I think that we're micromanaging the project before it begins, and I've never seen it happen before, and I'm flabbergasted.
Especially in one.
Maybe we should do a little more micromanaging, because we just went from 25 to 35, but
we're supposed to macromanage.
Yeah, I think we should have probably chosen a site as well. It should have been up to a legislative vote, but that didn't happen. And that's a lot of these things have passed, and it's unfortunate. I had a quick question. After the executive decided that we didn't want to use all this county-owned property, and he had this idea out of nowhere about a 60-acre brownfield. Did we, and this is the cost, because we paid 10% of this right now is the purchase cost, which seems high to me. Did we hire a realtor? Who, Dennis, did you do the negotiating, or did Pat Ryan do the negotiating? Who negotiated? Because the legislature went and got an independent appraisal, and it came in at 1.2 after the first appraisal that was ordered, I think, by the executive branch of government, asked for an appraisal that looked at the property as pristine, which is an odd way to do an appraisal. But who did negotiate that price? Because it's 10% of the cost at this point.
So I wasn't involved in the negotiations of the price.
Who was?
I can't answer.
Did we have a realtor?
Well, what I would tell you is we had an appraisal.
It came in at 1.2.
No, our appraisal came in at 4.3, I believe.
Yeah, the cover sheet asked for it to be looked at. The parcel's pristine.
Yeah,
that's odd.
So but we had two different professionals look at it, and
one pretended it was pristine. The next one looked at it what it was. Okay, and it was 1.2.
And that, well, I don't accept what you said as a premise in terms of what that first appraisal was. But that's not the key here. The key is that we went through a process from that, and then we went back. I did not go back from the executive office. Somebody went back to the to the owner, and they arrived at a price.
Who went back to the owner?
I don't have an answer for that question. The answer I would give you is that at the end of what happened, there was a price that was agreed upon that was put in front of the legislature, and the legislature decided that they were going to purchase the site.
I'll just quote you, a hypothetical condition of the completion of the remediation of the site. they ask for that in the appraisal. With a hypothetical, I've never asked, if I was buying a home and I bought them, I'd never get an appraisal with a hypothetical that it was in better condition than it was. But Doug, we don't have a lot of answers about this, and it is 10% of the cost, but.
Well, I guess we're past that.
Let's see, Kale.
So, you know, it was stated earlier that we've spent the meeting talking about furniture and things like that, but the truth of the matter is we spent the first hour and three quarters of this meeting talking about things of much more substance, like the water systems and the increased cost and the estimates going forward on the amount of work that has to still be done. So I think we're just, you know, trying to get our heads around the, I'll speak for myself, I'm trying to get my head around the increased cost at this point of the design phase when we're only 30% through, and I was somewhat comforted to hear that they don't anticipate a dramatic increase in that. However, but looking at it from where we sit today, with a 30% of the design phase done and a basically $10 million increase in the cost already, gives me pause. And I think that's part of our job as the Ways and Means Committee to do that. And if we have not signed the purchase and sale agreement yet, I think we should know all of the information before we go ahead and do that. And if we're looking at a project, because some of us were around at the end of the jail, right?
Not me.
No, but some of us were.
I wasn't around at the beginning of the jail either.
Right, neither was I. But I was here for the end. And I can tell you that the stack of change orders that came in weekly for that was tremendous. And the price of that thing just kept going up by the millions, 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 millions. And it was because the Ways and Means Committee and the department, the DPW committee, did not do their work ahead of time, right? So we have a precedent for us to go back and make sure that we're doing our job here. And I just want to put that out there because that's what this is all about. It's not about the need for the site and the facility. It's not about, you know, who knew who. It's not about any of those things for me. It's about making sure that we're doing our due diligence and that we're protecting the taxpayers for not to drag them into another boondoggle like we were in, what's that, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. That's it.
And I'll just, I'm going to go to Chair Bartels next, but just to expand upon that.
Over the last 2.5 years, three and a half years that I've been here, I can't recall one project that we've approved that the executive branch has not come back to us with a higher than originally proposed cost. So I think this is our due diligence. We should be asking these questions, and I think this is just going to, there's more skepticism now because of, at least for me, because every time we've been given an estimate, it's never been rung true. It's always been significantly higher than what we've been originally told. So I take pause of that a lot, especially with a project of this size and magnitude. Chair Bartels.
Thank you. Yeah, and I just would echo what both legislators Gavaris and Cahill said. I appreciate the executive's side of the house being forthcoming with this information, providing it to me and to legislative leadership, and I did make the decision that it was important for the entire legislature to have the same information in the interest of transparency and in the interest of all of us going into this project with eyes wide open. Like Legislator Cahill, I was here for the end of the elephant in the room jail project. I led the investigation into the cost overruns of that project. And a large portion of what led us there was that things were done in silence and secrecy behind closed doors, and at the point that, essentially at the point that an investigative journalist let the public know where we were at, then the legislature subsequently found out where we were at, and we had to deal with it. So I do realize that not all of these costs are attributable to the property.
Almost none of them.
But I do think it's important that every member of the legislature know that we're now looking at a project that has significantly more costs, and that every member of the legislature has the same information. It'll help us in moving into the next phase of the project.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just wanted to echo the concerns that the legislature have had in the past with respect to being surprised with respect to what happens to original estimates versus bids. And one of the things that the team did not want to do
was to come forward and continue to design a project when we knew we had significant costs that were not in the original cost estimate. I would not categorize the increase in costs as it relates to the project compared to the work that was given to the legislature when we first began looking at the site and looking at the alternatives. That was the construction costs. And what ended up happening is as we went into the design of the building and understanding all the technology that had to go into it, we rapidly came to the conclusion that there was going to be a significant investment in the technology within the building that the legislature didn't know about or wasn't cognizant of. And we wanted to make those costs transparent. We've now formed an internal team to discuss all of that work that needs to get done. And if you look at the work that's in there from Trophy Point and the work that's in there from our internal team, you can see that there's about almost a $7 or $8 million price tag assigned to the technology that has to go into the building. So when you start to take a look at where we were in terms of construction costs for the building itself versus the amount of the technology that has to go into the building to make it work, and the best building in the world for an EOC and a PSAP, if it doesn't have the right technology, it doesn't do the job that the county needs it to do. And so what we tried to do is when we found out the magnitude of those numbers, the team suggested that we come back to the legislature and we inform them of how much money we're going to have to invest in the building beyond just the size of four walls. And so that's why we're here tonight. We're here tonight to basically try to let you understand that we're pretty much where we said we were going to be with respect to the construction cost of the building, but there's a significant amount of cost that the legislature wasn't aware of and we wanted to make you aware of with respect to the technology that has to go into the building. So if you're looking at costs, particularly with respect to the Trophy Point and some of the material that's in your on the OneDrive, take a good hard look at that work that we've done relative to the technology that goes into the building. That work has been done by our IS department. They've actually gone back and taken a look at all of the material that would be needed for the technology and compared it to stuff that's on bid right now. It's on state bid. The furniture that's in the building that we're looking at is on state bid. That quote is from a state bid quote. So we have a good sense of what that equipment and will cost because we've gone back and done some homework on it. Doesn't mean it'll stay that way as we continue to move forward, but it does mean that we've pushed our consultants and our internal team to make sure that we had a really good understanding of those things that go into the building that are not related to its actual construction costs.
Thanks. Dennis, do you have some sort of a figure, even if it was a round figure, and if you don't have it tonight, I be happy to just wait for it, but how much it costs to put on this presentation tonight from our consultants?
The consultant team has been very understanding in terms of the county's approval process and the need to keep the decision makers informed. So my sense is that when we have an existing contract and they haven't asked us for any more money on that contract for the presentations that they've attended.
Not that we don't want to.
I just remember there being extra site costs when we expanded the siting the last time and went back to the same site again. And it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Just, I'm throwing that out there that sometimes those costs, and you guys have been fantastic and given us awesome presentations, and I'd love to see you. God bless.
Thank you for asking. So we don't have it in our, we don't have so many meetings, and then it's so many dollars per meeting thereafter.
Don't tell these people that.
I know.
For God's sake.
We probably should have, but we didn't, but it's okay.
Legislator Hampton?
I'm just wondering, and this doesn't actually have to be answered for now, but one of the senior legislators there. So the current location of the 911 center, my understanding is it's been there for 29 years without any infrastructure being done, just technology updates and so forth. My question is, what happened over all of those years? What happened 10 years ago? What happened 15 years ago? How come it has never come to be that work has been done? My understanding is Dutchess County is 20 years old and they're looking to either build a new one
or add on. Orange County's facility is 10 years old, and they're looking to do the same just for technology alone. So I'm not looking for a question now. I don't want to make this any longer. But if somebody could reach out to me and just give me an explanation for that, a little bit of history, that would be great. Thank you.
Unless you have the answer, Steve.
I thought it was the legislature.
Well, I figured maybe you would have that historical knowledge of her.
Yeah,
Tracy and Brian have been here since the jail, so.
Yeah, I'll give you more perspective, but I can say that the typical way that our budgeting works is that the executive side of the House brings forward a capital program that we approve, and they put into any given year what projects are going to be funded for that year, and until very recently, they did not put this project up to the top of the heap. I mean, it's really that simple. So for better or for worse, that's what's happened over the course of multiple executives.
I can say that the planning board, which has a responsibility to comment on the capital program, began with the passage of the charter in 2009, I believe that was, continued to make comments with respect to the capital program about the need to invest in our 911 center. And those comments never made it into the recommendations relative to a capital project. And then recently there was a recommendation in the capital program to relocate the 911 center without having any consideration with respect to the EOC. And we started down that road, and the building that we were proposing to locate it in couldn't meet the requirements for a 911 center. And that was the...
So GL Rotunda?
Well, we looked at the GL Rotunda. This was sort of the find another spot that works. And then they actually looked at the area where Family Court was, that area there, and they looked at that, and they actually did an analysis on it and recognized that the building wouldn't meet the requirements. And so with that, we kicked off the idea that we would have to do a much more detailed look at what a need for a 911 center was. And from that, we ended up with a contract that essentially had two critical components associated with it. One would be the design component or the programmatic space component for how big a project should be here. And the second piece of that was where should it go. And so when the team of Urban came on board, they had GPI to do the work with respect to site selection, and then Urban to do the actual programmatic space, and that's how we got to where we are today.
That's the money.
Pretty much done. We had asked for a cost analysis a while ago, and we received this little thing with no backup, and it between Golden Hill. Two options at Golden Hill and Paradise Lane, it literally came down almost to the dollar, the exact same amount, even with the price of the purchase included. None of this has made a lot of sense. I think it would have been done quicker had we gone with another site. I think it undoubtedly would have been done cheaper when you take into account the money we're going to have to spend with regards to water, the purchase price, and then whatever the remediation we end up doing. And we still don't even know what we're doing with the water. But yet, we ended up here without a lot of backup, and now we're hearing that there's all these other things our consultant didn't think about. When you combine in relationships and all those other things, I think it's time to honestly look at a second set of eyes before we go forward, but that's my opinion. I doubt we will, but the jail would have been a lot better off with another set of independent eyes, and I think it's at that point when we go from 25 to 35, and I look back at documents I got with no backup, everything seemed to be forcing us, pushing us towards this one property. And I think in a lot of ways, it's not the best property. So I'm on the record for the last year on that. And I don't foresee this getting any better. I foresee this getting more costly and taking more time, especially with regards to now these water questions.
With the absence of anybody from finance or from one of the deputy executives, just a question and maybe the controller can answer this. We would still have to follow our procurement policy for all of this project, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so with the three, I guess more just, I'm putting it out there as a statement more than anything. So
legislator Criswell that, you know, we would have to go through a three bid or it would have to be a C bid pricing. So there is some protection in that respect. You know, it was mentioned before, I think Legislator Uchitel is the one who brought it up about, you know, being self-sufficient for a period of time. You're basing all these guidelines off of NFPA standards for design of EOC and PSAP. Is that correct?
Hey, NFPA does have guidelines, that's correct. And there's also NINA, NINA as well, has standards for cost and
PSAP.
All right. So it's not to add more cost to this, and but bringing it up just for, you know, just like a food for thought. The FCI guidelines, which I know is more healthcare related, but in the newest edition that will be coming out and more likely will be adopted for 2027 standards, is the island model, which I haven't heard of it. I didn't either until a few months ago. It's where you're completely self-sufficient for 96 hours. That means backup water supply. It's not using diesel generators anymore, using generators at all. It's actually having on-site storage of energy, and it's not even batteries, it's kinetic energy storage. So you can be completely self-sufficient and self-contained for 96 hours without any additional outside resources if you had to. So I don't remember who brought it up about the prolonged period of outage. You know, 72 hours is good for a generator, but it's a mechanical piece of equipment that does have its limitations and potential for failure. So not that I want to add more costs, but maybe if we are looking at being an island, you know, for this really critical key infrastructure of ours for the county, there may be some ways to look at that as well. So instead of just battery storage for the immediate need, for it could be for an extended period, or kinetic storage, which I think we're getting closer to that.
Yeah, certainly, you know, making certain that it never goes down is key, hence the redundant service from Central Hudson, the diesel generator. There's also a hookup for a mobile generator, and then the UPS system specific to the critical equipment. And as I say, it's not in there yet, but we are certainly having discussions, you know, as of this year about the energy storage system. It would be outside of the building. It would allow for peak shading and keep the costs down in that way, as well as the resilience factor. So, but we could look into that as well, the idea of kinetic storage.
And the New Paltz Water District, is that gravity or is that pump? Do we know?
I believe it's gravity. There's a... there's a large water tank up above South Putt Corners Road. Behind, near where the DEC is also.
Okay. Good. Question for you? Question?
No, just nodding. I'm picturing that tank.
All right. Does anybody have anything else?
I have a piece of business before we adjourn, but not for
okay.
that.
Well, thank you, everyone, for your time tonight and
thank
all
you.
The information.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I have concern about the fact that Legislator Walter was allowed to zoom into this meeting as a committee member. I don't believe that that's allowable under our rules. I don't believe it's proper. If it is proper, I wish that I would have been able to, I wish that I would have thought to attend from her house, because it's a solid, you know, 25 minutes closer to home for me than this is tonight, and we all have to try to schlep back up here next Tuesday rather than doing this all in one night, which would have made a whole lot of sense. For the most of the meeting, she was not visible in person, which is one of the rules that comes to zooming into a meeting. We've had a great view of her ceiling, though. I just want to know why you, Mr. Chairman, allowed that, and where you found it to be allowable, because I don't find it to be allowable.
I asked the question to end this meeting, and granted to the clerk, it was supposed to be allowable.
By whom?
By the clerk.
Of the legislature?
I don't have that authority. I can speak to it. Yeah, I can speak to it. So, my understanding in consulting with our attorney, and also this has been a long, ongoing debate in relation to open meetings and the interpretation of open meetings, is that it is allowable, but something that we in this body have been trying to avoid in the interest of our staffing of committee meetings. I felt that the exception in relation to a meeting that was informational where no action would be taken and where we were looking to get the most
participation possible was an acceptable exception, but it is allowable via open meetings. It's a matter of how you interpret the
yeah, I don't interpret it the way you interpret it, and quite frankly, our rules don't allow for it. Our rules are specific to allow legislators to video conference into our legislative meetings, but it does not allow it for committee meetings.
We can have an extended conversation, if you like, with council, and again...
Well, I mean, there's no council here tonight.
No, but again, our interpretation of the open meetings law has been a point of ongoing discussion in order to allow for some restriction in our committee meetings, because, in fact, there was long a discussion that we would have been required to allow anyone to attend via video conference in our committee meetings, regardless of what our rules said post-COVID.
Don't those rules require that you be in person visible?
That portion I don't have in front of me right now. I'm just speaking to the
ability
to attend.
I'd like you to look at
it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's she's not.
Okay, that's
for 90% of the meeting.
That
she said her piece at the very beginning about the water.
Not,
and then disappeared.
Again, I'm not speaking to that portion, and I will look at that. I know that when we have Zoom people meeting in, sometimes you can see that sometimes they go off, sometimes put the screen on black, sometimes not. I'm not speaking to that aspect, but I am saying that the interpretation of the open meetings law, and I'm talking from extended conversations that our clerk, myself, and our council have all had with Committee on Open Governments, it has changed radically post-COVID. And again, we were looking for the ability to not have to allow Zoom at every committee meeting, because it would have been very difficult for the staff to run hybrid meetings at every committee meeting. I made the exception conversation with the chair of the committee in relation to a meeting where we knew no business was going to
you
take place.
You thought no business, because anybody can make a motion on anything while this meeting's in order.
I suppose. I mean, I didn't think of it that way. Thought of it just as the ability to provide this information to anyone. I didn't have...
Well, that would be a special information meeting of the legislature, which is customary to happen for these things, where legislators would be able to zoom in. But this is a committee meeting where any business could take place, and you made a unilateral decision that Legislator Walter, amongst the rest of us, I mean, I don't know if you were notified, Brian, that you would have been able to zoom in. I certainly wasn't.
She wasn't notified that she would be able to zoom in. She requested to zoom in when she heard that the meeting was happening.
She wasn't notified. From your opinion, I would not have to show up to another committee meeting for the rest of the year. I could zoom into all of them.
No, that's not from my opinion. From my opinion, the interpretation that we've utilized here is that we're not permitting zooming into committee meetings. Again, an exception was made for a meeting that was for the purposes of information where no action was to be taken.
But that's not a thing. That doesn't exist. You're making that up as a reason, you know, where no action would be taken. Because how do you know no action would be taken tonight?
Well, there was
I was I was considering
agenda.
I was considering making a motion to, you know, have the Ways and Means Committee demand that you sign the purchase and sale agreement, which would be a valid motion. It would probably be defeated. I would say almost definitely be defeated. But that would be an action that was taken.
I expected that this was going to be an informational, the equivalent of an informational meeting, that we were providing information as was stated in the agenda.
That's what special informational meetings with the legislature have been since I've been a legislator. Every single chair except for you has held it that way, rather than doing it in a Ways and Means Committee meeting. And it almost seems like it was intentionally done this way so Eve could, you know, I'm not saying it was, I'm saying it seems like
that. It absolutely was not. As I said to you on the phone, it was so that more members could zoom in.
But the committee would have to be here. That's exactly how you couched it to me on the telephone.
Right. Yeah, I did not know, I was not aware that Legislator Walter...
I make a motion that Legislator Walter's
not counted as attending for the purposes of attendance.
I think we need Chris for that, because I think to advertise it appropriately we might have to, but I don't know.
I don't know.
But I'll withdraw the motion. Chris can stay wherever he is in the ephemera.
Speaking of motions, I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Right, let's just get Chris.
No,
okay. You're good? Okay. To the motion?
A motion to adjourn.
Second.
I'll second.
Second. All those in favor?
If I vote no, is there enough votes to adjourn?
Yes.
Yes,
three.
Three
of them here.
One,
two,
three.
John.
Oh, right, John, three. I'm opposed to adjourning.
Do you really
and,
not want to?
Walter doesn't vote.
No, she doesn't vote because she's not seen.
Her ceiling votes no.